Jamison Health Talk, Hero News Radio, 1200 WKST. Lisa Lombardo with a week off. Patty Eppinger, Director of Medical Staff Services, right?
Absolutely.
How are you?
Great. How are you, Ken?
Welcome back.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here.
So what's going on? You said a lot of things are happening.
A lot of things are happening. We have a lot of new doctors that have come on board. We have a lot of services that we're providing in the community. Our OREER project is continuing on schedule, so the public can see a lot of that activity going on. And this morning we have a great speaker to talk a little bit on anxiety.
And he is?
Dr. Mark Matta.
And, of course, Dr. Matta has been with us in the past. Welcome back. Just a little quick little background for you, education, all that, and
sure.
Where you're from. I know you're from here.
Yeah, I'm born and raised in Newcastle. I went to Neshannock High School. Went on to Allegheny College and then Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. And did my residency in adult psychiatry at Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh. And then I came back here and joined my father in his practice.
And so, how long you been doing it now?
I finished my residency in 2007, so I've been here about 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the relationship between you and Jamison?
It's been great. They provide the two programs, really, that I think are essential in mental health, and that is an inpatient psychiatric unit as well as a partial hospitalization program, both of which I think have come a long way over the last, 20, 30 years in its evolution. And mental health in general, I believe, has come a long way, and Jamison supported that. And I feel like it's a very valuable resource to the community. I know there, in Pittsburgh anyway, there were a lot of psychiatric inpatient units that have been closing. And I feel like that's a detriment to society because you're denying a level of care that, in my opinion, is very essential for the community. So Jamison continues to have their inpatient unit and their partial programs, and I think they've been very successful.
And give us a little history lesson on that too, Patty, because that all came about with St. Francis, correct?
Correct. As everyone knows, years ago, St. Francis Hospital of Newcastle had the psychiatric services, and Jamison really didn't handle that in the past. And then we decided to pull together a partial hospitalization program. And when St. Francis Hospital of Newcastle, we actually acquired them,
right.
We took over the behavioral health services. So we had our partial hospitalization program, and we combined it with the inpatient unit. And, of course, it is at our South Campus, which is, of course, the old St. Francis Hospital was at Jamison South Campus. And I think the facility is excellent. I think we have a very good population of acute. We have the geriatrics, and then the psychiatric inpatient, and then the partial hospitalization program is growing.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that's so important? The in-hospital scene for some?
Well, some patients require inpatient hospitalization. Those patients that are acutely a danger to themselves, a danger to other people due to mental health problems, or in some way cannot take care of themselves, require inpatient hospitalization. And if that's not available, then you're forced to send them or ship them off to another hospital somewhere where it's not near their hometown and their family cannot be involved. And it just creates a lot more of a burden on the patient and on those that care for them. So to have one in this community, we get referrals from all over the place because there's a shortage of beds, around Western Pennsylvania, even Eastern Ohio. And I know when we accept those patients that it becomes such a problem to get the resources set up for them back where they're supposed to be and even to transport them back. I mean, it places an extra financial burden on whoever it is that's paying for those services. So to have one in the community, I think, is very valuable, and it's a necessary treatment that should be available to all mental health patients.
The deciding factor for in-hospital is what?
We look at three criteria, okay. And a lot of this has come about mainly due to insurance criteria, and that is that they are, again, an acute danger to themselves. Either they intend on harming themselves in some way or in some way wanting to end their life. Danger to other people, so perhaps their mental health causes them to have thoughts of hurting other people. And the other factor is an inability to care for themselves. And we find this more in the elderly population, those with dementia that are used to be able to care for themselves and now can no longer do that. They leave the stove on accidentally and somehow pose a danger to themselves that way. And those are the main criteria that we look at for inpatient hospitalization.
The difference of people dealing with mental illness compared to just our everyday emotions.
And I get this question a lot. You know, why should my emotion be treated? Emotions are natural. Everybody has them,
right?
And I say, listen, if your emotion is causing the situation to become worse, that's when it needs to be treated. If you're, for instance, I use the example of losing a loved one. It's natural to feel sad. We're expected to feel sad. And as a matter of fact, there's no diagnosis for natural sadness due to loss of a loved one. We call that bereavement or grief. If you become so sad that you're not functioning, you have thoughts of wanting to join your loved one that is deceased, and you have thoughts of ending your life for that purpose, well, that is a little different, that your emotions are now making things worse,
right?
And that's when they need to be treated.
Because we all handle the grieving process differently, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And it I find that it's also culturally connected. For instance, I come from a Middle Eastern background, and in the Middle East, death is not accepted very well whatsoever, no matter when it is, whether it's an elderly individual that lived a good life or obviously a tragic young person that passed away. Compared to even in this country, as a matter of fact, I think that they learned how to handle death in a much more calm and collected manner. And even with that, I mean, the change in lifestyle, you know, you have couples that have been married for in excess of 40, 50 years, and to lose that part of you.
Right.
And there's nothing that's going to treat that, really. But you try to at least create a level of functioning that is acceptable and as beneficial as possible to that individual. But
Do we see it in some cases lead to depression and some other problems?
So in mental health, the diagnosis of bereavement is not supposed to last more than several months. Now, if your grief continues longer than that and, again, is causing dysfunction in work, it's causing dysfunction in personal life, then we kind of go on to call it a depression. So there's a possibility of tipping the scale the other way. So it might start off that you're handling it well, and then as you go on without that loved one, you find you're missing that person more often, and it's just you're kind of going downwards instead of recovering. And at that point, we can't call it a depression and treat it.
But there's always trigger points with this, aren't there? Because of just of you know, I mean, I've got parents gone 14, one and 20, going on, 26 or 27 on the other. But there's always points where...
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's something that's normal, correct?
Yes, absolutely. It's not that you want to forget that the death ever occurred or want to deny it or cover it or throw it under the rug or something like that. No, absolutely not. It's not about forgetting. It's about controlling the emotion. If you feel like you have lost control over your emotions, that they are dictating everything that you do, every thought that you have, and causing things to get worse, you're more irritable with family and friends, you're not able to get to work on time, you're not sleeping well at night, you're waking up in the middle of the night without cause or concern, in almost a panic sometimes, then those are kind of the signs and symptoms that, you know what, maybe I need to get it looked at. And, you know, bring it up with your primary care physician. If you need to, go ahead and make an appointment with a psychiatrist or a therapist and allow them to maybe dictate it if you have a question. That's what I recommend.
You know, so many shows here with Jameson I'll Talk, we've talked about the idea of stress management, what stress does. Is stress anxiety? Is anxiety stress?
Yeah.
And how do we differentiate between the two?
Well, they're interchangeable. It's stress and anxiety are the same. I more or less define anxiety as ultimately a fear response. We get afraid that something bad is going to happen. That's where our anxiety comes from, either whether it's watching a football game or taking a test or speaking in front of public. Whatever it might be, you're afraid that something bad will happen, either an embarrassment or some sort of physical problem might happen or whatever it might be. And as a result, you actually get physical symptoms from that fear, and that's kind of where the anxiety causes problems. The one thing I want to point out about anxiety is, in my opinion, it's the ultimate example of the mind-body connection. A lot of people don't really give the mind enough credit for how powerful it is. It's the most powerful organ, not only physically, you know, with the brain controlling everything in the body, but also psychologically. The mind can control the body. I mean, we hear it all the time, mind over body, right? Mind over matter. And we see that the most successful athletes are able to overcome many of the problems that they occur as they go through their individual or team sport, and they excel because they're able to get over things and move on. When we suffer from anxiety symptoms, we see a physical reaction. I use the example of if you have a fear of heights and you're standing over a very tall bridge or on a tall building, right? You look over, and what happens? Your heart starts to race. Your hands start to get sweaty, and you start to break out in a sweat and perhaps get panicky. You might get short of breath. And why is the thought of, you know, falling or whatever creating these physical symptoms? Why is the psychological stuff creating a physical response? And that's what I mean when I say that it has a mind-body connection. We're seeing a heart racing. We're seeing sweaty palms. We're seeing all these sometimes nausea.
Sounds like you were with me when I was taking somebody to the emergency because I thought it was, thought it was a heart attack.
Sure, yeah. And many people can confuse that. And, I'm sure the ER doctors would agree with me when I say that one of the most common complaints that is not a heart attack ends up being a panic attack. And many people, unfortunately, confuse the two, which is very understandable because you have similar symptoms.
Yeah, the heart racing, the
sweating.
The
pounding out of my chest, the fear that, quote-unquote, I might be dying.
Passing out,
yeah, right? I mean, you have this sense of derealization or surreality. All kinds of these odd types of symptoms that you've never experienced before. A mentor once told me that the first time you ever experience a panic attack, you will never forget it. You will know exactly where you are and what was going on. And that's how powerful and potent panic attacks are.
Well, then what are the different types of anxiety disorders then?
Anxiety disorders cover a spectrum of different mental illnesses. It goes anywhere from generalized anxiety disorder, which is at its core a difficult time controlling how much you worry about things. But it also encompasses.
Okay.
but it also encompasses obsessive compulsive disorder, and many people assume that they have that. But when you kind of dig deeper, they may not. It covers panic disorder, and panic disorder is not simply having panic attacks; it's having more or less intractable panic attacks that do not go away, and the panic attacks cause problems. We categorize panic attacks further as with or without agoraphobia or fear of enclosed spaces. So a person can suffer from panic disorder with agoraphobia if when they leave the house, they're having fears of having panic attacks. And that dictates everything that happens when they leave the house. They are looking for exits whenever they're somewhere in an enclosed space because they're afraid if they have a panic attack, how am I going to get out of this situation? I don't want to draw attention to myself. I don't want to induce more of the panic. And panic attacks are also kind of self-feeding. So when you think you're having one, then you almost instigate one, and you feed it. It's kind of a snowball effect. So panic attacks, again, are panic.
Are there certain triggers?
Yeah, and sometimes there aren't any triggers. But yeah, if you have a bad memory or you're exposing yourself to a traumatic situation, for instance, post-traumatic stress disorder is also under the anxiety spectrum of disorders. If you suffered a trauma in a certain place and you go back to that place, and then you start re-envisioning that traumatic experience, then you could induce a panic attack. But also they can come without cause whatsoever. Some people have panic attacks that wake them up from sleep, and they're not able to get a good night's rest because there's a panic attack that happens every night at 3 o'clock in the morning. So sometimes there are triggers, and sometimes there are not.
Then you kind of mentioned this a little bit earlier, but if... So you really don't know if you're experiencing one or not then, huh, for the very first time?
No, I get all kinds of complaints that I've had a panic attack, and what I try to do is corner them into expressing exactly what symptoms they're having, and then I'll make my best decision as to whether they had a true panic attack. Some people assume that increased anxiety is a panic attack. And when I dig deeper, I say, well, how long did it last for? Oh, it lasted all day long. And by definition, a panic attack will not last all day long. Usually they come on suddenly. It's an extreme rise in anxiety. You have this shortness of breath. You have this, you know, heart pounding, this sweaty palms, nausea, whatever it might be, dizziness, lightheadedness. It lasts anywhere between 15 minutes and 45 minutes to an hour at most, where they it just takes them that long for the body to recover. But after that, it goes away. And it kind of goes away as quickly as it came on. So that, in its essence, is a panic attack. And some people, again, confuse just increased anxiety or a fear response of some sort as having a panic attack.
Now, when you're talking with the patient, do you like to talk with other family members about this too? Or
I think it's essential to talk to other family.
Now, do you hear from a lot of the family members think, well, he or she, they just have difficulty handling situations? Do you hear that quite a bit?
Absolutely, yeah.
So you tell them what then?
Well, I try to get a feel for, is the family minimizing or do they have a true grip on what's going on? Is the patient in some way dramatizing, or does the patient have a good sense of what's going on and the family does not? You kind of have to feel for both parties involved. But I think that it gives us a better overall history. You get two sides of a story instead of simply just one. So I feel like as a clinician, it's very difficult for me to assess a situation without the family involved. And everyone on the inpatient unit, especially the staff, will tell you how much I encourage family meetings, because I like to kind of air out all the dirty laundry.
You've talked about this before.
Yeah.
You think it's...
I talk about it all the time because, like I said, as a clinician, in order for us to get down to what the truth is, we need to get as much information as possible. And if that means talking to the family, if that means talking to any acquaintances that might have any inkling, it's kind of being an investigator or a detective in a case, right? You're going to interview all parties involved to find out what really happened. And it's the same way for a clinician. And it goes the same for the medical community, too, the physical medical community, where you want to find out exactly what happened. Did this person have a seizure? Did this person, you know, what symptoms did they have that might point whether it was a seizure or not? So it happens across all avenues. But because we're dealing with emotions, which are so subjective and are so diverse and variable that and can't be measured on a blood test or an x-ray or anything like that, then we need the family. They kind of are our x-rays and things like that.
So if we've seen it before, we know what it is. When it happens, what should we do?
Well, I would say try to get control and understand that you're having a panic attack and that you're not going to die. Now, if, again, it lasts more than an hour, I would say, then perhaps you're not having a panic attack, you're experiencing something else, and you should get it looked at. But if you can withstand the initial onslaught of the anxiety, and for those that have experienced panic attacks, they know when they have them, and they can get control over them, and they say, I just wait it out, I go for a walk. They use some natural remedies. In the partial hospitalization program, they're very good at teaching coping skills, ways of dealing with anxiety symptoms, so that you don't have to, you know, turn quickly to a pill or something else that you know, to treat it, but rather use natural coping methods. But having said that, there are some treatment options that are available.
And
too.
They are what?
Well, primarily we use antidepressants to treat anxiety. And people say, well, I'm not depressed. Why do I need an antidepressant? The reason antidepressants work is because they work on the same chemical that induces anxiety, and that is serotonin. So all the antidepressants, every single one of them, Prozac, Zoloft, Celexa, all these other antidepressants, also are used for anxiety, panic attacks, and so on.
Okay.
Those treat what I call overall anxiety, anxiety that is kind of always there and doesn't go away. Then there are other medications called benzodiazepines. These are the Xanax, Klonopin, Ativan, Valium. These medications are best used for situational anxiety. So as I mentioned before, if you re-experience a traumatic scene or something like that and you start getting anxious and start developing a panic attack, you would take a benzo because they act very quickly and they wear off very quickly.
Mm.
But ideally, they're not best to be used long-term. Because, again, it's kind of a roller coaster ride with the benzos. It's like taking Tylenol for a headache. When you feel a headache coming on, you take a Tylenol, headache goes away, the Tylenol wears off after a few hours. It's the same idea with the benzos. Mm-hmm. So ideally, the best way to treat the anxiety medically anyway is to use an antidepressant to treat them every day to keep the anxiety at a low level. And then use a benzodiazepine for breakthrough symptoms. And if you have a panic attack or an increase in anxiety, you take a medication and ideally, the anxiety will go away. The other option that we have, the non-pharmaceutical option, is individual counseling or group therapy, where you, again, learn these coping skills that can help you outside of the use of medications. And I believe that the combination of therapy and medication is probably the best way to treat anxiety overall.
So how do you have people deal with, as you said, what this is, their fear?
they have to recognize what it is that, that makes them afraid. And therapy...
Is failure the number one?
What do you mean by failure?
I mean, just no matter what we're going to do, that the fear of failing...
I'm sure that's a huge part of it, absolutely.
Whether it's school, whether it's work, whether it's...
Yeah. We everyone wants to succeed. Everybody wants to provide. Everyone wants to live. Everyone wants to eat. So this is something that's been going on since the beginning of time. I think as society changes, as there are more pressures to produce, as there are more demands and constrictions on our time, that the anxiety level goes up along with that. You know, we're not... hunting and gathering anymore.
Right.
We're now, going to work, working 9 to 5, coming home, supporting an entire family. And, with this advent of digital age and immediate accountability for things, we feel like the anxiety levels have gone up on everybody. So, yeah, I would say that the fear of failure is a huge aspect of that. But I also think the fear of embarrassment, the fear of damage or somehow harm to self also drives some of that. That same mentor that told me that you'll never forget when you have your first panic attack experienced one himself. And at that time, he was in medical school. He had finished studying for an exam and felt like he was ready, so he took the night off. He was watching television, and all of a sudden, the panic attack came on. So subconsciously, he was afraid of this upcoming test, even though he thought he was ready, and that's what brought about the panic attack.
How about your office and the Behavioral Health Service Unit at the South Campus? What can you tell us about it?
Well, I have my own private practice
up
in Neshannock Township. If anyone is interested in making an appointment, they're welcome to call my office. The number is 724-652-2323, and we offer medication management. I have two wonderful physician assistants and a nurse practitioner that also practice with me. I also have several counselors and therapists that can provide individual counseling. As far as the partial hospitalization program, that's a day program that occurs Monday through Fridays. Patients come in at around 9 o'clock in the morning, and they leave anywhere between 1 and 2 o'clock, depending on their particular treatment plan. And they attend group therapy sessions, they attend individual counseling sessions, and medication management sessions. And people stay in the program for as long as they basically need to, and as long as they're willing to. If anyone's interested in that program, that's more of an intensive program. It's meant to get somebody back up on their feet. Either it's reserved for those patients that have had a hospitalization and are coming out of that hospitalization or are not functioning that well in their day-to-day and just need a higher level of care. And if anyone's interested in that, you can talk to your primary care physician, your psychiatrist. But the referral number for that is 724-656-6220, and they can schedule you with an intake appointment.
Patty, response from patients that have gone through this?
I think it's a very successful program. Dr. Matta is the medical director for the partial hospitalization program, and that has actually been very, very successful. Individuals that have gone through that have been able to go and maintain, their lifestyle again.
Real quick, doctor, with a lot of things that we've talked about, do you start seeing people at a younger age with this? On the topic of anxiety?
Yeah, I think child and adolescent psychiatry has grown because I think the problems covering children are growing as well. The pressures to produce, I think the social pressures have also increased, what with Facebook and Twitter and all these things. And the bullying, I know, has become a larger topic. And so I think the demands on the children are bigger than they used to be. And so I am seeing more anxiety with them.
Yes. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
News is next, all out of time. Thanks, Patty.
Thank you, Ken.